From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's virtually impossible to get a ticket anytime soon to the Broadway hit The Producers. But on today's Fresh Air, you can listen to the songs from the show with the man who wrote the music, the lyrics, and the book, Mel Brooks. We'll also talk with Brooks about his 1967 film, The Producers, which his new musical is based on. Earlier this month, The Producers won 12 Tony Awards, a record-breaking number. Now Mel Brooks is one of the few people who have won a Tony, an Oscar, a Grammy, and an Emmy. It's springtime for Hitler on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. President Bush today called for concrete actions from Israel and the Palestinians to implement a U.S.-brokered ceasefire plan. After a NATO meeting in Brussels, Mr. Bush said making an agreement is, quote, just a first step. He said it is another thing for parties to act. CIA Director George Tenet today obtained Palestinian approval of ceasefire proposals already accepted by Israel. In the meeting in Brussels with NATO leaders today, President Bush pushed the idea of a missile defense shield. NPR's Don Gagne has this report.
The president's desire to set up a missile defense shield has been greeted with skepticism across much of Europe. In a meeting at NATO headquarters, the president did not provide any specifics as to what a missile shield will look like or how it might work, but he did stress how important this is for his administration. What he got in return was a willingness to listen from the other assembled leaders, though France and Germany in particular voiced strong concerns about the wisdom of a missile shield that they say may not even work effectively and which could trigger another arms race. Later, the president spoke briefly with reporters after his motorcade made a stop at a Brussels chocolate shop. He said that he felt the meeting at NATO went well, saying this trip has been good in that he's getting to know his European counterparts and that they are seeing that he's committed to a strong relationship between the United States and the European Union. Don Gagne, NPR News, Brussels.
The rate of crime in America continues to decline, with violent crimes down 15% last year. That's the sharpest drop in the 27-year history of the annual survey by the Bureau of Justice Statistics. Property crimes are down also. NPR's Peter Kenyon has more.
The violent crime rate has been falling since 1994, and property crimes have been declining since 1974. Last year saw both trends continue. The latest Justice Department report says in 2000 there were 25.9 million violent and property crimes in the U.S. That's nearly 3 million fewer than in 1999. It's the lowest figure since the survey was begun in 1973. Analysts have cited the strong economy and the maturing of a large teenage population as contributing to the decline. In a statement, Attorney General John Ashcroft said the Bush administration is committed to ensuring that all Americans can walk the streets of their neighborhoods without fear. Democrats see the report as further vindication of the Clinton administration's anti-crime program, which is unpopular among Republicans and a potential target for budget cuts. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Washington.
It was a down day on Wall Street today with additional profit warnings causing concern about the health of the economy going into next year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 76 points and closed at 10,871, an active trading of just over a billion shares. The Nasdaq Composite fell 48 points and finished at 2121. This is NPR News. Sparks flew between Democrats and Republicans today over the highly politicized issue of power prices and shortages in the western states. With Democrats now in control of the upper house, the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee heard from economists today. Most recommended more government action to limit price rises until more generating capacity becomes available. Republicans at the meeting were skeptical that price controls would either be useful or temporary. In a sign of the continuing economic slowdown in the auto industry, General Motors today announced it is closing one of its longtime assembly plants in central Michigan. Quinn Kleinfelter from member station WDET has more.
The world's largest automaker is closing its engine plant in Delta Township, near the state capital of Lansing. The plant produced roughly 3 million engines during its two decades of operation and has been that area's largest private employer. General Motors is idling about 1,000 workers from the plant. Nearly a third have already accepted early retirement or been reassigned. The carmaker says the plant's remaining employees face at least temporary layoffs, but GM hopes to reassign them to other plants as well within a few months. GM is replacing the Michigan engine plant with new factories in Ohio and New York, while building new vehicle assembly plants in Lansing and Delta Township. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
A top Mexican drug suspect was captured today as he used a payphone, according to Mexican authorities. The capture occurred on the same day U.S. prosecutors unsealed an indictment charging that Alcides Ramon Magaña and a Mexican governor transported 200 tons of cocaine through the Caribbean coast. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from White Wave, the makers of Silk, a lactose-free organic soy milk available in the refrigerated section of supermarkets and natural food stores. Silk is soy.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we talk with Mel Brooks about the hottest show on Broadway, his show, The Producers.
Opening night. It's opening night. Will it flop or will it go? The house lights are dimming, the footlights are bright. The toast of society's burning tonight. We're so excited, we can't sit down. The springtime for Hitler has come to town.
That's music from the new cast recording of The Producers. This month, the show won a record number of Tonys, 12, including Best Musical, Best Book of a Musical, Best Original Score, and Best Actor. The book, the music, and lyrics were written by Mel Brooks. He adapted it from his first feature film, The Producers, which he wrote and directed. That won an Oscar for Best Screenplay. The show stars Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick in roles originated in the 1967 film by Zira Mostel and Gene Wilder. Let's start with a clip from the movie that sets up the story. Zero Mostel is Max Bialystock, an over-the-hill producer desperate for a hit. Gene Wilder is his accountant, Leo Bloom. As Bloom is going over the figures for Max's latest flop, he has this thought.
Amazing. It's absolutely amazing. But under the right circumstances, a producer could make more money with a flop than he could with a hit. Yes, it's quite possible. If he were certain that the show would fail, a man could make a fortune.
Yes?
Yes, what?
What you were saying. Keep talking.
What was I saying?
You were saying that under the right circumstances, a producer could make more money with a flop than he could with a hit.
Yes, it's quite possible.
You keep saying that, but you don't tell me how. How can a producer make more money with a flop than he could with a hit?
Well, it's simply a matter of creative accounting. Let's assume, just for the moment, that you are a dishonest man.
Assume away.
It's very easy. You simply raise more money than you really need.
What do you mean?
Well, you did it yourself, only you did it on a very small scale.
What'd I do?
You raised $2,000 more than you needed to produce your last play.
So what? What did it get me? I'm wearing a cardboard belt.
Well, that's where you made your mistake. You didn't go all the way. You see, if you were really a bold criminal, you could have raised $1 million.
But the play cost me only $60,000 to produce.
And how long did it run?
One night.
You see? Do you see what I'm trying to tell you? You could have raised $1 million, put on a $60,000 flop, and kept the rest.
But what if the play was a hit?
Well, then you'd go to jail. Oh. See, once the play's a hit, you have to pay off all the backers. And with so many backers, there could never be enough profits to go around. Get it?
So in order for this scheme to work, we'd have to find a surefire flop.
What scheme?
What scheme? Your scheme, you bloody little genius.
I meant no scheme. I merely posed a little academic accounting theory. It was just a thought.
Bloom, worlds are turned on such thoughts.
Well, as the story continues, producer Max Bialystock and his accountant Leo Bloom decide to follow through on this scheme by finding and producing the worst play ever written, Springtime for Hitler. The film The Producers had several great songs. Those songs are also in the show, along with new songs written by Mel Brooks. The Producers is not just a hit, it's a Broadway phenomenon. Mel Brooks, welcome back to Fresh Air. Did you expect this kind of reaction, a record number of Tonys, an editorial in the New York Times, the cover of the New Yorker, even the cover of the New Republic? I mean, everybody, everybody's talking about it.
Of course I did. I mean, I knew it would all happen. I mean, it was just, Are you kidding? this is so phenomenal. I mean, we were just hoping that it wouldn't be a flop. That's all, you know. We were hoping for a hit, you know, hopefully, you know, more than a modest hit, but a good, solid hit. We didn't know whether musical comedy would resonate with theater goers because for the last 15 years we've had a lot of, you know, Les Mis and Phantom of the Opera and Miss Saigon and those kind of, you know, semi-operatic, heart-tugging, you know, theatrical events. And we didn't know whether we'd be welcome.
Let's start at the beginning. When you were first coming up with the movie, The Producers, how did you come up with the scam that's at the center of the movie and the show, which is that a producer can make more money with a flop than a hit?
100 years ago, I was working for a producer in New York, who was right around here, right around. We're broadcasting from Carnegie Hall, actually, in the building. He wore an alpaca coat, winter, summer, fall, and spring. He wore a black producer's hat with the brim down on both sides. He wore a cape. He made love to little old ladies, and for that, they invested in his shows. And his leather couch in his office always had a little old lady in it, on it, around it, about it. He never stopped making love to these little old ladies. They never stopped giving him checks. And they would often, the dialogue was often like this. What's the name of the play? And he would say, Cash. And they'd say, gee, that's a funny name for a play. And the quid pro quo was terrific for both of them. The little old ladies were happy because once again, they were adored and kissed and held passionately in a man's arms. And he got his little green, blue, and yellow checks, you know, so he could put on his flops.
But did he have a scam like that of thinking he could make more money from a flop than a hit?
Everything he touched was doomed. he never knew. You know, he always hoped for a hit. He was my model for Bialystok. But once I wrote it, I thought I added that Leo Bloom, the accountant, would come up with this simple little scheme that if you raised more money than you needed, you could, and you're sure that you had a flop, then you could keep the money, because no one would be asking you for money, because they knew it was a flop, and so their investment went down the tubes.
So you never tried it or knew anybody who did?
Well, you know, after the movie came out in 67, I got letters from Broadway press agents and people that said, you know, this guy did that. This guy, you know, he said this was a scam, you know, that actually worked. And it was before the IRS was so diligent and before bookkeeping was so important. And they would, guys were doing this kind of thing.
So
I thought I made it up.
Now, when you came up with the idea of Springtime for Hitler, did that idea precede your concept that you had to come up with the worst show ever written, or did you know you had to come up with the worst show ever written, and that's how you came up with Springtime for Hitler? Which came first?
I knew they had to have a flop.
Right.
And then I searched for 6 months. I was writing morning, noon, and night. I couldn't find the right flop. Just like they read.
Right.
Just like Bialystok and Bloom, you know, reading it in that little office filled with...
Yeah, scripts, they're searching, you know, for the worst play ever written. But you had to create the worst play ever written.
I had to create the worst play. I couldn't find the worst play ever written. So I created it.
Now, did you come up with the idea that a musical about Hitler, with dancing and singing Hitlers and dancing and singing Nazis, would be just the thing? That would be the worst play ever written.
Well, in those days, it was pretty dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, the war was only over for 19 or 20 years, you know, And here, we were taking, you know, taking Hitler to task in a funny way, you know, and Hitler wasn't to a lot of people. I mean, Holocaust victims and, you know, and World War II horrors. And, you know, this was not such a funny subject, you know. It was a pretty, you know. But I was always a tasteless fool, and I always felt that being politically correct would be the death of comedy, that comedy had to explore every vein that should be explored, that there should be no boundaries. You go where you have to go, and you do what you have to do in comedy. And if they hate you, they hate you. But, you know, that's what you got to do. So for me, Hitler was fine. A lot of people who saw the movie were very much like the people in the movie who were gobsmacked and aghast at seeing a swastika on stage, you know. I had one incident, by the way, right here in New York. Only one. Thousands of people have already seen the show on Broadway, but there was one person, and my heart went out to him, and I was angry at the time, of course. He found me. I was sitting in the back of the theater during previews, and he said, he came screaming, "How dare you? There was a Holocaust. Hitler was a terror. You're making fun with Hitler." And he's screaming at me at the back of the house. It was during the bows. People were applauding, so they really didn't hear him. But he was shouting in my face. He was red-faced. He was a guy about 84, 85 years old. So screaming at me, and he said, "I was in World War II. Well, I was angry, very angry at him. I shouldn't have been, but I was at the moment. So I said, "I was in World War II also. I, too, was in World War II. Where the hell were you? I didn't see you anywhere." I said, "I was in the combat engineers. Where were you?" You know, and I was screaming back at him. And anyway, but I could see that he didn't get it. Now, why he didn't walk out in the first act when the plot revealed that we were going to do Springtime for Hitler, when we met Franz Liebkin, when, you know, I don't know why he didn't. How come he lived to 85 years and he never saw the movie? it's a Jewish person, you know. I mean, it's like you get bar mitzvah and then you go see,
a Mel Brooks film.
You know, right, yeah. So, I mean, I didn't get that either. But he was the only one, and in the end, you know, I felt, you know, I apologized because he just didn't get it, you know, and just like the people in the movie that didn't get it, they were outraged, you know. But by now, everybody is, you know, knows that we're using the Hitler thing to make it the worst play in the world. So they get it. Yeah.
And I really think that it's because you feel so strongly about what Hitler did that you're able to make something this funny. Do you know what I mean? It's because it matters to you so much, you're able to really do something that's funny. That's always funny.
Yeah, true. I've always said that, you know, these guys are brilliant orators. They are. All despots have the gift of persuasive speech. And if you get on the soapbox and try to argue with them, you're finished. These guys will win. But if you can somehow ridicule them and make them laughable, then you'll always succeed. And their legacy will not triumph. So one of my jobs has always been to make fun of Hitler and the Third Reich. And I've done a very good job at it. And, you know, I made them pretty ridiculous guys. Yeah.
Now, did you ever say to yourself, maybe I'm going too far?
Never. I've always said to myself, have I gone far enough?
Right. Push it more.
Yeah. I mean, that's my, you know, that's my mantra. That's my flag. My flag is you can never go too far.
Did you have family who died in the Holocaust?
I think I did. I'm pretty sure because my family came from Danzig, and which was German then, and from Bialystok, which is the name of the guy.
I figured you had family from there because your main character's name is Max Bialystok. Yeah, producer, the main producer.
And you know, so I am guessing that those Jews in my family that didn't get out. We're probably herded, together put on railroad cars and taken to Auschwitz or whatever, one of those terrible camps.
My guest is Mel Brooks. We'll talk more about his Broadway hit, The Producers, after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mel Brooks. We're talking about his Broadway show, The Producers, about a producer and his accountant who cook up a money-making scheme to produce a show that's a surefire flop so they can walk away with the investors' money when the show closes. The musical is based on Brooks' 1967 film, which starred Zero Mostel and Gene Wilder. In this scene from the film, the two are busy reading plays, searching for the flop their scheme requires, the worst play ever written.
Max, let's face it, we'll never find it.
Oh, we'll never find it, huh?
Yeah. Smell it? See it? Touch it, touch it.
What is it?
What is it? We've struck gold. Not fool's gold, but real gold. The mother lode. The mother lode. The mother of them all.
You found a flop.
A flop? That's putting it mildly. We found a disaster, a catastrophe, an outrage, a guaranteed to close in one night beauty.
Let's see it. Let's see.
This is wine, women, and song, and women.
Springtime for Hitler. A gay romp with Adolf and Eva at Berchtesgaden. Wow.
Wow. It's practically a love letter to Hitler.
This won't run a week.
A week? Are you kidding? This play has got to close on page 4.
Bialystok and Bloom go on to produce the show. It has an outrageously tasteless, show-stopping production number called Springtime for Hitler, featuring singing and dancing Nazis, showgirls, and Busby Berkeley-style choreography. Here's the song from the new Broadway cast recording.
Deutschland is happy and king. We're marching to a faster pace. Look out, here comes the master race. Springtime for Hitler and Germany. Rhineland's a fine land once more. Springtime for Hitler and Germany. Watch out, Europe, we're going on tour. Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
Look, it's springtime.
Winter. Germans, go into your dance.
I was born in Dusseldorf, and that is why they call me Rolf.
Don't be stupid, be a smarty. Come and join the Nazi party.
Now, Mel Brooks, isn't that your voice saying, don't be stupid, be a smarty, come and join the Nazi party? And didn't you also do that line in the movie?
Yes, what I did, I taped it for the movie. I mean, I recorded it for the movie, and I recorded it for the show.
And why that line? Why did you want your voice on that line?
No good reason. I think the guy who did it wasn't getting the lilt in. And I wanted it to be exactly like, don't be stupid, be a smarty, come and join the Nazi party. And he didn't want to be, you know, quite so... I don't know, simple, and I needed it to be that simple and lilting, and so I did it myself. In the recording room, I did it, and Mike Hertzberg, who was the assistant director, said, why don't we put your voice in and let him mouth it? I said, okay. So we did that, and then it worked so well that Susan Stroman...
she directed the show.
Who directed the show said... Why don't we put your voice in there just the way you did in the movie? And I said, sure. So I recorded it.
Now, you mentioned that you were in World War II. You were in the combat engineers. So did you see combat?
Where
were you stationed?
I'm sent over in 45. The war was nearly over. We arrived in sometime at the end of January. The Battle of the Bulge had already been fought. And I came in on a new wave, moving across the Rhine at Remagen, the Remagen Bridgehead. And then we moved into Germany, and we moved into, actually into Alsace-Lorraine. And I finally ended up Frankfurt up Mons. We had some skirmishes out. The Germans were in flight. I mean, we were fired on by a lot of kids and old men who were left in the villages. They were called werewolves or snipers. And long-range 88s, which were immensely accurate. For instance, I was a radio operator in a combat engineer unit, and we'd figure out a position and tell the artillery, you know, to knock out a German post somewhere. And the minute we broadcast, we had to hightail it out of there, because 10 seconds later, the road would be straddled with 88 shells. I mean, they would zero in, and they were amazingly accurate.
Now, did you and your fellow soldiers tell Hitler jokes?
Oh, yeah. Once, actually, the Germans at one point broadcast to us, foolishly, that we would be treated well according to the Geneva Convention if we laid down our arms, because they did have, they thought they had a semi-surrounded, but they didn't. And they broadcast with these big bullhorns. Die Kanzen war reingesput, was ist gemacht, the Geneva Convention, nicht gewaltig schießen, blah, blah, blah. I don't know what the hell they were saying, but they were yelling in German. And so I picked up our bullhorns, and I sang, "Tut, tut, tutsie, goodbye. Don't cry, tutsie, don't cry." I did this whole Jolson thing. And believe it or not, at the end of it, I thought I heard a German applause, you know, from the other side.
Did you really do that?
Yeah, I really did. What the hell? The bullhorn was there, and I was a good singer. And I thought I'd give him,
No one shot at you during that?
Well, I mean, we were far apart, you know.
Right.
You know.
And did you tell Hitler jokes also?
I think so. I mean, you know, I mean, I told as many Hitler jokes as I could think of, you know. It was only later that I organized. I was able to use Hitler exquisitely later on in life.
Right.
When I was doing The Producers. So, but, you know, he really paid off for me, Adolf. Adolf really came through for me, you know. I'm so grateful to him for being so funny on stage. I think I said that at the Tonys.
Mel Brooks will be back in the second half of the show to talk more about The Producers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You will join me in singing and dancing the Führer's favorite tune, Der Guten Tag Hop Club. All right? Key of E?
Is there any other?
Wunderbar! Eins, zwei, drei! Guten Tag Hop Hop, Guten Tag Club Club. Ach, du lieber und, oh boy. Guten Tag, clap, clap. Guten Tag, slap, slap. Ach, du lieber, what a joy. Oh, essen und fressen und tanzen und trinken. Tanzen und trinken until we get stinking. Everybody, Guten Tag.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, writing the music for The Producers, we continue our conversation with Mel Brooks.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mel Brooks. We're talking about his Broadway hit musical, The Producers, starring Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick. It's adapted from Brooks' 1967 film, The Producers. The show features many new songs written by Mel Brooks, along with the songs he wrote for the film. The cast recording has already been released. Let me play another song that you wrote. Well, this is from this is in both the movie and the show, The Producers. And this is called Haben Sie gehört das Deutsche Band. And
that's again using the German. I love to use the German to make fun of the German. So this is Haben Sie gehört das Deutsche Band, which means in English, have you ever heard a German band? Was in the movie, The Producers. It was only about 8 bars, and I took it, put it into The Producers on Broadway, and made a whole 32-bar song out of it.
Okay, let me just explain the context here for our listeners who don't know the story. This is during the auditions to find the worst actor in the world to play Hitler in the worst play ever written. And one guy is auditioning as Hitler, and the playwright, Franz Liebkin, thinks that this guy isn't investing enough masculinity in his depiction of Hitler. It has to be more masculine. So the playwright steps in and does it himself to demonstrate how it should be done. So here's Brad Oscar as the playwright, Franz Liebkin, singing.
Haben Sie gehört das deutsche Band? Mit der Bang, mit der Boom, mit der Bing, Bang, Bing, Bang, Boom. Ah, haben Sie gehört das deutsche Band? Mit der Bang, mit der Boom, mit der Bing, Bang, Bing, Bang, Boom. Russian folk songs and French ooh-la-la can't compare. This is a German oom-pa-pa. We're saying haben Sie gehört das deutsche Band? Mit der Zett, mit der Zapp, mit der Sing. Polish polkas, sehr stupid und sehr rotten. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that Schweigen, Reigen, Schoner, Schützen, Schmutzen, Sauerbraten. Key change! Wer sang? Haben Sie gehört das deutsche Band? Mit der Set, mit der Sap, mit der Sing. It's the only kind of music that the Huns und the Honeys love to sing. That's our Hitler!
I mean, that's a great number.
That's a great
number. That's our Hitler. I love the way Nathan Lane jumps up and screams, "That's our Hitler," knowing he's got the worst actor in the world to play Hitler. And doesn't
right.
realize that waiting in the wings, he has an even more terrible actor.
But Mel Brooks is funny because you had to find great actors to play the worst actors in the world.
Yeah. Now, this guy, Brad Oscar, was an understudy. And he was understudying the guy we originally hired to play Franz Liebkin, and who's very good. His name is Ron Orbach. But Ron Orbach, who's a very sensational talent, we hired him to play Franz Liebkin, but he actually hurt his knee, like in the show, broke his leg so badly that he couldn't do all the steps and things. So the understudy, like Ruby Keeler, you know, you're going out there a little, you know, a little chorus girl, and you got to come back a star. So we said to him, you're going out there a little understudy, and you got to come back, you know, a star. And he did, and he's been doing it ever since, and he's got the role now, and he was nominated for a Tony, and Brad Oscar is on stage every night.
It's a great performance.
Brad Oscar is very talented.
Listening to Das Deutsche Band song, I'm thinking, like, do you ever think, well, boy, I bet if Hitler wasn't showbiz, he wouldn't be very good. he might have been quite the Führer, but he wouldn't have been a very good song and dance man.
No, I don't. He didn't have rhythm. He didn't, you know. Actually, Ethel Merman would have been a much better dictator because she had it all. She was just as loud as Hitler, just as strident, but she could sing and dance. And Adolf couldn't pull it off. As a matter of fact, one of the lyrics in Springtime was, in the Heil Myself version, is, if you remember, is that I'm the German Ethel Merman, don't you know? So, I mean, I always think of Merman because when I was a little kid, I saw her, and she actually made me want to be in show business.
Are there any specific songs or specific musicals you had in mind while writing your own songs for the producers?
You know, I love music. I love songs. And I love melody. And my favorite guys have always been the guys that could really write both the words and the music, like Frank Lesser and Jerry Herman and Irving Berlin and Cole Porter. I mean, those are really the great songwriters of my time. And when I was writing the score for the show, I would play an awful lot of Cole Porter and a lot of Irving Berlin, Lesser and Herman, to get the feeling of that Broadway, you know, that pit sound, that mm-hmm. that orchestra in the pit of a Broadway show sound. And I had them playing Morning, Noon, and Night. And never, I like Rodgers and Hammerstein a lot, but I didn't play them because that wasn't the sound I was after.
Right.
I was after an earlier period that meant so much more to me. I was after musical comedy.
Now, let's get back to the producers. In addition to having a big song and dance number about Hitler, there's a big gay number that's sung by a couple of flaming queens, shall we say. And this is the kind of humor that gay people are likely to find either very funny or kind of offensive. And this is a very, I think, very funny song called Keep It Gay. And it's a song sung by the worst director in the world who's hired to direct Springtime for Hitler. It's sung by him and his common law assistant. And it's a song basically acknowledging that many theater people are gay and many shows have a kind of gay sensibility. Tell me what made you decide to write this song for the show.
Well, when you meet characters, you try to set their characters in a song. It's as simple as that. Now, first we meet Bialystok. So he's got a song. It's all about him. You find out all about it. It's called King of Broadway. You meet Bloom. I want to be a producer. You meet, that's what he's all about. They join up. They seek out the worst play and playwright in the world. They find Liebkin. So it's incumbent upon the songwriter of the show to write a song that tells you who Liebkin is, right? They leave him, and they go to Roger Debris' apartment, and they meet Roger Debris and his wonderful, assistant, Carmen Ghia. So, got to be a song about those guys. Now, they are extremely, flagrantly, funnily, excitingly, and beautifully gay. So that's why I wrote Keep It Gay, because that was a beat that had to be covered. So I covered it.
Why don't we hear Keep It Gay? And this is Gary Beach as the worst director in the world, Roger Debris. Music and lyrics by my guest, Mel Brooks, from the cast recording of The Producers.
Ooh, it's a wild idea, but it just might work. I see a line of beautiful girls dressed as stormtroopers, each one a gem, with leather boots and whips on their hips. It's risque, dare I say, S&M!
Love it!
I see German soldiers dancing through France, played by chorus boys in very tight pants. And wait, there's more! They win the war, and the dances they do will be daring anew. Turn, turn, kick, turn, 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 kick, turn, one, two, three, kick, turn. Keep it sassy, keep it classy, keep it...
That is brilliant, brilliant! Roger, I speak for Mr. Bloom and myself when I say that you are the only man in the world who can do justice to Springtime for Hitler. Will you do it, please?
Please?
Wait a minute! This is a very big decision. It might affect the course of my entire life. I shall have to think about it. I'll do it. I'll do it! Sabu, champagne!
Ah! If at the end you want them to cheer, keep it gay.
Annoy us
and ruin our nights. So keep your string birds and it's at bay.
I'll
sign
Roger Elizabeth Debris.
Keep it gay.
Okay, that's one of Mel Brooks' songs from his new show, The Producers, and that's from the new cast recording. I imagine you met a lot of gay people, made a lot of gay friends when you started working in theater.
Oh, yeah. In those days, it was so, you know, frowned upon, and, you know, and this, that's terrible because, you know, half of us in the theater are gay, and the other half are Jews. And, yeah, so I don't know. You know, it's a good mix, you know. I'm kidding. I mean, I don't want you to write letters. If you don't get it, don't write letters.
But it shouldn't bother you, right? You should just be prepared for that, right?
I am. I feel sorry, you know, for a lot of people who are upset, you know. We've never had a gay complaint, you know, in the show.
Really?
We had a Hitler complaint once, but we never. The gay community is 110% behind this show. They love it. They love the people in it. They love our embracing whoever is gay in the show. And they know we're just, you know, there's a lot of love for people in the theater, whether they're gay or straight or whatever. You know, we love theater people, theater types.
My guest is Mel Brooks. We'll talk more about his new Broadway hit, The Producers, after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mel Brooks, and we're talking about the new Broadway production of The Producers, which recently won a record number of Tony Awards, and the cast recording is out now, too. Now, let me play another song from the show, and this song is based on a line from the movie. After producing the show that was supposed to be the biggest flop in the world, the producers find out the show has inadvertently become a big hit. And Zero right. Mostel, as Max Bialystock, the producer, says, "Where did we go right?" And you've built a whole song on that phrase. Did you know right from the start that line has to be a whole song?
It was the first song I wrote for the producers. It was so natural. "Where Did We Go Right?" is such a natural song that, you know, it's really a litany of woe. So it had to be told, and it's a delicious, you know, if I say so myself, a delicious, funny, you know, funny, melancholy for the guys, you know, tune. And it works. It works so well in the show, you know. And I'm glad you're going to play it because Nathan and Matthew do it so well.
Absolutely, and we'll talk about them after we hear it.
Yeah.
No, this track starts with Nathan Lane as Max Bialystock reading the great reviews for Springtime for Hitler, knowing that these great reviews mean that Bialystock and Bloom are on their way to prison. So here's Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick singing "Where Did We Go Right?" from the cast recording of The Producers.
How could this happen? The show was lousy and long. We did everything wrong. Where did we go right?
Christmas came early to Broadway this year, and guess who they stuffed in our stocking? Adolf Hitler.
It was so crass and so crude, even Goebbels would have booed. Where did we go right?
Last night, a star was born on Broadway. The lovely Miss Ulla Inga Hansen-Benson Janssen-Tollen Hollands-Faden-Svansen. We predict that her name will soon be up in lights, if they can find enough bulbs.
We searched Broadway on and off for singers with a cough. We had tryouts and auditions by the score. And to trip the light fantastic, we picked dancers who were spastic. If anyone should take, we should take them out the door. They shouted hooray for that sausage on display. Where did we go right?
Our leading man was okay. He nearly flew away. Where did we go right?
A show so easy to despise.
Now it's up for the Pulitzer Prize.
Oh, where, tell us, where did we go right?
best new musical of the decade. Max Bialystock is a theatrical genius. Now they like me. Oh, we knew we couldn't lose.
Half the audience were Jews.
It's the end of our careers.
It'll run for 20 years.
Tell us, where did we go?
That's Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick from the cast recording of The Producers. My guest, Mel Brooks, wrote The Producers and wrote the songs for The Producers. Well, good idea to cast Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick in the two leading roles. How did you know they'd work so well together? Did you test them opposite each other to see what their chemistry together would be?
No, not at all. We knew them individually, and we knew their sensibilities. We knew their personalities, and we knew they'd mesh beautifully. But before we knew Nathan had to be Max Bialystock right from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And before, of course, you know, Nathan was going to be our star. So before we cast Matthew Broderick, we sat down and talked to Nathan about it, and he thought it was just a great idea because he thought Matthew is such a great actor that he could get close to the Gene Wilder feeling, which was so important. A lot of acting goes into Leo Bloom. It's really Leo Bloom's story when you think about it, because Leo Bloom is a caterpillar at the beginning who, you know, the arc of his march of character turns him into a butterfly. So, I mean, from caterpillar to butterfly, and you need a very talented guy. And the only thing I didn't know was whether or not Matthew Broderick could sing. I knew he was in a show a couple of years ago called How to Succeed in Business, but I didn't hear it. So I rushed out and I got the cast album, and I heard this choir boy, this beautiful voice and sweet, you know, sweet Irish tenor. And I didn't even have to audition him for singing. I just thought he was... I thought he was so great. So we would just head over heels in love with both of these guys, and we thank God every day and night that we got them on stage together, because I mean you couldn't want a better Bialystock and Bloom than Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick.
Did you want Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick to watch The Producers over again and see what the original performances were like, or did you want them to forget that and just do it their own way?
I wanted them to do it their own way, but of course they would agree that they were influenced. You know, they had to be influenced by Zero Mostel and Gene Wilder. They had to be. There was no two ways about it.
What was Zero Mostel like to work with? He's such a big character. He was probably that way off screen too. Big.
It was wonderful in hell, you mm-hmm. know. When he was in a bad mood, it was hell. And when he was in a good mood, there was nobody greater in the world to be around than the joyous, effusive, ebullient Zero Mostel, you know. And the bad moods, you left the room as quickly as you could, because he'd be a raging rhinoceros, you know. And if he ever charged you, look out. But thank God bad moods were very few, and good... He abounded in good moods, so we were very lucky.
Did the bad moods ever interfere with the filming?
Well, once in a while, not much. You know, he was a very professional, cooperative guy, and Gene was an angel right from the beginning.
My guest is Mel Brooks. We'll talk more about his new Broadway hit, The Producers, after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mel Brooks. His musical, The Producers, is the hottest ticket on Broadway. He wrote the book, the music, and lyrics for the show. It's based on his 1967 film, The Producers. Mel Brooks, one of the rules that producer Max Bialystock tells his protege, Leo Bloom, is there's two cardinal rules of producing. Rule one is never put your own money into a show. Rule two is never put your own money into a show. Mel Brooks, you put your own money.
That's not exactly the reading.
Okay.
The reading is a little different, if you don't mind, Terry.
Please,
the
you reading, do it.
He's, rule, there are two cardinal rules, Bloom, because Bloom starts with, how much do we put up? And Nathan slips and falls and gets up and says, Bloom. There are two rules when producing a play on Broadway. One, never put your own money in the show. And then Bloom says, and what's two? And Nathan screams, never put your own money in the show. So, I mean, there's, you know, you just don't repeat the two lines, you know. One of them is a lot bigger.
I guess anyway, I failed that audition.
Yeah. But anyway, we got to get you, you know, a drama coach, and I think everything is going to be fine.
Okay. Well, anyways, after writing those two rules yourself, you know, about never putting your money into your own show, you're one of the producers of The Producers, which I suppose means you put your money into the show.
Actually, no. I'm an honorary producer because I traded my underlying rights for a producership, and my underlying rights were worth as much financially as any of the producers. So that's how I become a producer. But I never put a penny into the show, and now you know, who knew? I wish I would have put $1 million into it. I mean, I would have gone to a bank and borrowed it, and I would have been rich today. But I'm okay. I'm, you know, who's complaining? You know. Just my author's share alone could get me a Needix hot dog and an orange drink every day until I die. So,
you know, when I saw The Producers, one of the things I thought about was one of the problems with a Broadway play is at the end of Act One, just as you're about to hit intermission, no one wants to sit in their seat applauding. Everybody wants to make a beeline to the bathroom so that they could get there before the really, really long line. and I'm wondering if you think about that when you're ending Act One, you know, that people are going to be, like, running out as soon as they can.
They don't have to because, believe it or not, Rocco Landisman and Jude Jampson have put in a lot more toilet seats.
That's true. That is true.
You know, there's a lot of toilets in the St. James Theater, so you know, there's no you don't have to scramble for the three or four. There's about 25 of them. But it's true, it's wonderful. I know people who just wait for that curtain to start to descend and they fly up the aisle so they can get a, you know, chance to get into their Jane or John or whatever, you know. But you know what's wonderful about The Producers? When the show ends, the audience is like a bunch of kids. I mean, I actually had to write a song to chase them out because in Chicago they wouldn't leave. So I wrote this song in Chicago, you know, thanks for coming to see the show. Remember that song at the end?
Yeah, yeah.
It was, you know, it was a sweet way to say get out, you know. Actually, we do say get out at the end of that song, you know. Nobody, you know, I used to do that when I was a kid in the mountains. We used to write those, you know, sorry that the show's over, but you got to go now, that kind of thing. But no one has ever done it on Broadway, so I said, what the hell, I'll write one for Broadway. And I did. And it tells the audience that the show is over and they should put their hats on and their coats on and they should get the hell out of the theater because the people have to clean up, you know?
Mel Brooks, congratulations on the success of The Producers and thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, I love your show.
Oh, thank you for saying that.
I love Fresh Air. I love it. I mean, I'm not just saying that. It's a great show. You do a beautiful job, and thank you for a wonderful, quick, and amazingly quick, even though it was an hour, interview.
Mel Brooks wrote the book, the music, and the lyrics for the Broadway hit, The Producers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. And Maria Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with another song from the cast recording of The Producers.
Gotta sing, sing.
Boys, break's over, let's take it from the top.
This is good. Hey, Bloom, put me down for 10 grand.
Prisoners of love, blue skies above, can't keep our hearts in jail.
Tempo, fellas, pick up the tempo.
Prisoners of love,
that's it.
Our turtle dove,
yes,
will soon come and round with bail.
Sing out, boys,
boys,
let them hear your solitary.
Gentlemen, you are hereby granted a full pardon for having, through song and dance, brought joy and laughter into the hearts of every murderer, rapist, and sex maniac in Sing Sing. You're free!
Free!
Next stop, Broadway!
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, stories of the men who raised the American flag at Iwo Jima during World War II. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the age of corporate newspapering, how the pressure to increase profits is affecting coverage of the news. We talked to Gene Roberts and Tom Kunkel about their new book, Leaving Readers Behind. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.